It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we look back four decades to a time in Wisconsin's juvenile justice system when youth were incarcerated without hearings often will meet the group of people who battled to change it.
First, the Milwaukee ex-police officer who shot and killed Silvo Smith has been charged with first-degree reckless homicide.
Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm this morning filed a criminal complaint against former police officer Dominique Hagan Brown, who shot Smith during a traffic stop on August 13th this year. The shooting set off days of unrest in the city's Sherman Park neighborhood.
John Diedrich is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and joins us now. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a breaking news story. Can you update us on where we're at right now?
So today the district attorney's office in Milwaukee charged Dominique Hagan Brown, Milwaukee police officer who shot Seville Smith, and charged him with reckless homicide. The police officer had also earlier been charged with sexual assault that was unrelated to the shooting of Seville Smith.
And why are these charges, the reckless homicide, coming out right now?
Well, this has been the result of an investigation that's gone on for a number of months. Just to help listeners sort of rewind, the shooting happened in August, and following that, there was unrest and rioting that happened in Sherman Park. There was a lot of questions about what the video would show, the body camera video, and so forth. The early indications were that this was a shooting that was justified in the fact that Seville Smith had a gun. He was armed at one point in the altercation. But this criminal complaint, which is, again, the result of several months of investigation, concludes that, in fact, Seville Smith was not armed when the second shot was fired, a killing shot, into his chest by Officer Hagan Brown.
And so this started as a traffic stop, and Seville Smith was running from the police. They were pursuing him. Did that pursuit follow standard procedure in a case like that?
Well, we haven't seen the whole internal investigation, and there had been some questions as to what the nature of this stop was. Hagan Brown was with a partner. This is an area where drug dealing has happened. There's also had been some shootings recently. So it had been suggested that those were the bases for making the stop. The criminal complaint suggests that that was part of the reason to initiate the stop. It doesn't, for the purposes of this criminal complaint, they're not talking about were rules followed or not followed in that case. What they're really focusing in on is the officer's use of force at that case. So if you sort of back it up and say, was this stop justified? That's really an internal investigation question, which the police department continues to conduct parallel to the criminal investigation.
And is there any proof that Silville Smith fired at the officers?
There isn't any indication in here. From the criminal complaint, which is actually quite brief, as these sorts of cases tend to be sort of longer, but what happened was he was running from the officers. He turned and he had the weapon in his hand, and that when he raises the gun upward, in other words, he slips and falls, and as he turns to the officer and he's raising the gun upward, that's when he shot once in the arm. But then he throws the gun over, this is Seville Smith, mm-hmm. throws the weapon that's in his hand over the fence into the yard, and that his firearm did not discharge. So, though the weapon wouldn't have had to have discharged for officers to use deadly force, if somebody points a weapon at an officer, they could use deadly force depending on the circumstances. But from this point, the weapon is raised up, he shot once in the arm, and then the gun, you know, is gone at that point and is no longer a factor in it. And after that is when the shot that actually killed him was fired.
We are talking with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter John Diedrich right now. We are talking about the breaking news that former Milwaukee police officer Dominique Hagan Brown has been charged with first-degree reckless homicide in the death of Silvo Smith this August. Now, one of the interesting aspects of this story, John, is that there are actually some interesting parallels between the lives of the victim, Silvo Smith, and the officer who has now been charged in that case, Hagan Brown. Can you share some of those with us?
They did grow up in similar neighborhoods, and when you say similar neighborhoods, not like on the same block, but within relatively close proximity. They didn't go to the same school, but there was definitely commonality in terms of people that they knew. And that particular neighborhood, Sherman Park, there were instances where they would have crossed paths from the interviews that we did. There also was, you know, similarities to African-American young men who had come up with a number of the challenges that those young men are facing in our community right now. In terms of the paths, they divert at some point. And Seville Smith is actually, he's wounded in a shooting and is involved in a number of incidents, arrests, and things of that nature. A couple years before he actually dies in this shooting. In contrast, Officer Hagen Brown becomes a police aide, which is a way to get into the police department for young people who are interested in that, and becomes a police officer, really patrolling parts of the area where he grew up in Sherman Park. So their paths were sort of intertwined, and then at some point those paths diverted.
So as we briefly mentioned earlier, within hours of the shooting, protesters descended on Milwaukee's Sherman Park in the neighborhood where Smith had lived. And the protests really did escalate quite significantly over that weekend and even longer. What do you think it was about this particular shooting that created such a spark for the unrest?
Well, there have been a number of incidents of use of force in Milwaukee as well as other cities. I think it was a combination of things. One of the questions that we asked the colleagues here wrote a piece that really looked at, well, why did this take so long and why this shooting? I think part of it was the sort of atmosphere that we're in right now, the number of incidents, Ferguson and South Carolina, other places where police officer use of force has really come into the spotlight. And, you know, video. Now, we didn't have any cell phone video of this, but it allows sort of quick dissemination of this sort of these sorts of incidents. It also happened during the day. It was in summer. It was in an area where there had been issues in the past, particularly related to a gas station in the area. I don't think that really played into it, though that ended up being a business that was burned down. But it sort of just overlaid the fact that here's somebody who was known in the neighborhood. There had been a number of people on the street, and it just became this flashpoint there. And then when, you know, sort of the sense of a group action unrolled, it started with the looting of that particular gas station. And it really started with focusing on a police officer's car and looting that, and that got burned, and then it really unfolded from that. A number of other businesses were looted and burned as well, and that went on for really that whole night, and there was some other unrest the following night, and it really took a while to quiet down, and things have still flared up. It's not as folks have said in the neighborhood. It's not over. There's a lot of emotion, especially around the memorial that has been erected to Seville Smith at the scene of the shooting.
And from those community members who have been trying to bring out the issues that have plagued that neighborhood for a long time, have they been keeping the pressure on to make sure that this investigation results in something like the charges that were filed today?
Well, yes. I mean, in terms of that, I wouldn't think that they would necessarily say, depending on who you talk to, that community leaders would say that they wanted to press for charges since they didn't have all the facts. Of the facts that they knew, they were concerned. The big question that community leaders, members of the family, the Smith family and others were like, where is the video? Why are we not seeing the video? Will we see the video soon? Mm-hmm. Because in other shootings in other cities, it has come out quicker. Though we may know now better a little bit more about why it hasn't come out, because the video will not come out right now in the same way as if he had not been charged, though it's likely that we'll see the video or portions of it during the court hearings, maybe as early as the preliminary hearing, which would be a couple weeks from now. But community leaders have put pressure on to say this you know, shooting needs to be thoroughly investigated and make sure that it's that we're not you know, that because he was a police officer, he's not going to get you know, sort of special treatment. The families talked about picketing. They went into a city council meeting not too long ago in Milwaukee City Hall and said, you know, we need some changes here to happen. We need the district attorney to take action in this case. So in my sense was they wanted a thorough investigation. You know, some would not have been happy without charges, especially given this fact set. And though, keep in mind, this is very, very unusual for a police officer to be charged in an on-duty use of force resulting in death. We're looking through, and there's no parallel, perfect parallel, but really the only case similar to this that's an exact parallel would be the Daniel Bell case, but that was decades ago, and it was only charged later when the officer's partner had a crisis of conscience. But really, we have not seen this sort of thing, and it's not just here, it's around the country. It's because police officers have the authority to use deadly force if they can articulate a threat that they thought was justified. In this case, the district attorney disagrees with that.
And as we wrap up, John, so former police officer Hagan Brown was arrested on sexual assault charges in October. That was an incident that actually is said to have happened the day after the shooting of Sylvell Smith. What is the status of that case right now?
Well, it is one of the just really odd, bizarre twists of this case. So, yes, he has been arrested and charged with sexual assault, not only in an incident that happened the day after, but an incident that happened before the shooting. And what the district attorney's office, the same one that's prosecuting him on the homicide right now, charges, they allege in the criminal complaint that he was drugging individuals, men that he was meeting in bars, and then having non-consensual sex with them. Some of this was recorded on phones, and they have some evidence of this and victim statements to this effect, DNA and so forth. Unrelated, apparently, to the shooting, but those charges were filed earlier, and those may or may not be combined with this homicide case. We don't know, but they do not appear to be connected at this point. So he essentially faces these two sets of very serious charges in Milwaukee County.
John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter John Diedrich giving us the latest on charges against a former Milwaukee police officer in the shooting death of Sylvell Smith this August.
Right now, we're going to take a look at Wisconsin's history of juvenile incarceration. Just 40 years ago, Wisconsin children and teens could be jailed or institutionalized without due process, sometimes even without a hearing.
In the 1970s, Wisconsin was the state with the highest number of juveniles in adult prisons, and children could be held in detention indefinitely.
Richard Phelps was a leader in the effort to change Wisconsin's laws. He's the founder of Wisconsin's Youth Policy and Law Center, which he directed from 1976 to 1983. His article, Securing Due Process, appears in the winter edition of the Wisconsin Historical Society's Wisconsin Magazine of History. He joins us now in the studio. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, talk about this. This kind of emerged gradually as you looked into it, but what kind of things were happening to kids and teens in Wisconsin in the 70s?
We start sort of towards the end of the story a bit, just to get a context. You know, we had the highest number of kids in jails in the country. But we didn't know it. It was a totally confidential system. There were no hearings oftentimes. You really had no due process rights to speak of as a juvenile. And so this went on and people didn't know about it. And normally a justice system is controlled by the state statutes. And in Wisconsin, the statute basically just said, do what's in the best interest of the child. So you had thousands of players, police officers, teachers, judges, prosecutors. All of them had power to do whatever they felt the best interest of the kid required, and we ended up with 11,000 kids in adult county jails a year, most of them in isolation cells because they had to separate them from adults. We had 6,000 in city jails, and then we had another maybe 7,000 in detention centers. So we were incarcerating kids for unbelievably remote things, and two-thirds of these kids had not committed crimes.
Right. Talk about the kinds of things that kids could find themselves in jails or mental health facilities for.
Well, as we began to discover what was going on, I was at the Dane County Juvenile Defender Program, which is kind of an experimental program at the time. And Dane County had a good system, relatively speaking, because of Judge Bruner. We sort of began to figure things out one case at a time, and then because we had runaways from around the state coming here, we started to learn about systems in other counties. And by the time it was done, for example, of those 11,000 kids in county jails, 1,000 of them were 13 or younger. The youngest was 7. And you could be there, and most of them were runaway school truants, and kind of what they categorize as uncontrolled kids. And there's no bail in that system. So you, once you're there, you don't get out until somebody comes and says, I'm going to take you out. So then we figured out, well, oh, wait, this is a disaster. And then I began to think about, well, maybe Mendota, maybe there are other systems that are locking kids up. So I would go out, I started to go out to Mendota, the mental health system. And sure enough, they were basically incarcerating kids there on what was what were called Sunday drives, we began to refer to them, which means parents would be in a fight with a kid. They think the kid's crazy for whatever reason. They don't know anything about community resources, and there weren't many. But they did know about the state hospital, and they would literally drive the kid to Mendota on a Sunday drive, say, we have to stop in the hospital. They would come back out, and the kid would stay under a contract. And kids wouldn't be released until the parent came back to get them, and sometimes the parents never came back. So I had clients there for 13 years and whatever before we discovered them.
And kids leaving at age 18, no education while they're there, and as they came out, many of them never a diagnosis of a mental health problem.
I never had, once we started to challenge this, I never had one single client adjudged mentally ill at Mendota. I had more troubled kids in detention oftentimes. It was a random thing. So I can remember when we first discovered this, I had an 18-year-old guy come to my office, and we had just begun to open up this whole problem, and he was released outright at 18. He had been there for 13 years, and I said, oh, my God, well, you got to get some community services here. Go down to the mental health center, and I started to name street signs for him on how to get there. He said, Mr. Phelps, don't tell me street signs. I said, why not? He said, I can't read anything. So here I've got an 18-year-old kid. He's been in Mendota for years. He cannot read. He has no shelter, and he has no community support. So how is that going to work out for the community? Not very well.
And in some cases, kids who were the victims of abuse removed from a home ended up in one or another of these systems.
No, there's no question. I mean, the runaways were the most difficult to deal with. Most of these kids were, like 51% of all arrests, by the way, were in the juvenile system, not the adult system. And many of these arrests were runaways because it was illegal then to run away. And there were, you know, we created Briar Patch later and other runaway centers. There were no runaway centers. It was illegal for many foster parents to get involved. So the choice was this kid gets abused at home, runs away, officer picks him up on the streets. You have to take him back to the abusive home or put him in the jail. Those were the choices.
And you encountered, as you dug into this, kids being attacked while they were incarcerated. Suicide, attempted suicide was one of the consequences here. This is hard on these kids.
Oh, it was, you know, it's hard for people to accept the fact that this was going on in our state and in our community. But, you know, we ended up passing a law, about a 120-page bill that changed it all. But to get that attention so that they would change all of this, we needed the public to know what was going on. So we started to sue county jails and with the Youth Policy and Law Center. And kids were killing themselves. They were trying to kill themselves. They were being beaten. And as we would take these cases on, then the public got it, because we couldn't tell the story, but the press could tell the story about what's going on in the cell, and the public started to get it. And that's when it started to change.
Now, these are stories that would be a better fit in a Dickens novel than in Wisconsin in our lifetimes. But it's also a story about changing it. You mentioned the law you passed. What did it take to make that change happen?
Well, we had to get the word to the public. We had to have a bill. So I was asked to convene these warring factions at one time, and I agreed to do that, certainly. They had to agree to the frame of reference, which was this has to be a due process model. We're not doing contracts in back rooms anymore. And if you agree to that, I will convene the group, which I agreed to do. We had the judges, the lawyers, we had the activists, we had the social workers and different groups. mapped out a drafting strategy, and we just produced this huge document. And it was an impressive effort by professionals who actually had to accept limits to their own power to make this happen. And then Dick Flintrop, a legislator from Oshkosh, ended up the prime sponsor, did a spectacular job. But the day the governor signed that bill, 12,000 kids left detentions and jails in Wisconsin each year. So, and due process rights. Now your parents had, you know, you could lose your kid in Wisconsin. They could take your kid away and you didn't even get invited to the hearing. That's how bad it was in Wisconsin at the time.
So a lot has changed under this law, clearly. As you watch the news today and you hear about the problems at the Lincoln Hills facility up north, these are kids who have at least had a hearing to find their way there, so maybe not as bad. But what do you think looking at that now?
Well, you know, part of what we ended up organizing the passage of Youth AIDS Formula after the Children's Code was passed, and that created a funding system where all the money was given locally. So we generated all the local resources, group homes, foster homes, runaway centers, all of that in Wisconsin, through this change in the correctional funding. And by just the dynamics of that, it closed all the juvenile facilities at a time when they were opening all these adult prisons. The only one left, after just recent closure by the current administration, is Lincoln Hills. The problem with Lincoln Hills is the system went dark again, and it's all confidential. So people... 40 years Lincoln Hills is operating, and there's no ombudsperson letting the public know what's going on. And it's not about bad people. It's about when you have power that is not held accountable and it's not transparent and there aren't rules, you're in trouble because it will drift into an abusive situation. And that's really what's happened at Lincoln Hills.
Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It's Richard Phelps. He founded Wisconsin's Youth Policy and Law Center. His article, Securing Due Process, is in the winter edition of the Wisconsin Magazine of History. Members of the Electoral College convene at their state houses next week to cast their votes for the next president and vice president of the United States. In most cases, if Donald Trump won an elector's state, the elector votes for Donald Trump.
But Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig is urging electors to vote their conscience and offering legal representation to electors who decide to vote for someone other than the candidate who won their state.
About a week ago, there were reports of about 7 electors considering that move. Today, the number has reportedly more than doubled, but it's still short of the number that would be needed to change the election outcome.
Lawrence Lessig joins us now. He's a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. He's also co-founder of the Electors Trust, a group that offers free legal counsel to any elector in the Electoral College who wants to vote for someone other than the candidate who won their state. Lawrence, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
So first of all, can you please give us a quick lesson on how the Electoral College works? Who are the electors, first of all?
Well, the Constitution says the states have the right to select the electors, but the electors themselves are federal officials, as Justice Jackson described them in the Supreme Court's most important case, describing their power, a case called Ray versus Blair. And as federal officials, federal officers, as he called them, what they have is a constitutional right not to be restricted by the state, telling them they have a legal obligation to vote one way or the other. As Justice Jackson wrote, no one faithful to our history can deny the plan originally contemplated the electors would be free agents to exercise an independent and nonpartisan judgment as to the men best qualified for the nation's highest office. But what the state can do is create a moral obligation. The state can say, we can't force you, but we can ask you to make a promise. And the question the electors have to decide is whether there's any moral reason sufficiently strong to justify them breaking the moral obligation they have to vote for the candidate that they've been pledged to.
So are there different requirements depending on what state that they are representing?
Well, basically all states except two, Nebraska and Maine, allocate electors on a winner-take-all basis that says the candidate that wins the most votes in the states gets all of the electors. And the way that those electors get divided or appointed or settled on is different in different states. So sometimes they're on the ballot, sometimes they're not. Sometimes it's two slates of candidates, sometimes it's just selected. But the really important differences are differences about the state trying to say, if you don't vote how you've promised, we will fine you. Some states say that. That's plainly unconstitutional. Some states say that you have to show us your ballot so that we can make sure that you're voting as you've promised. That also is inconsistent with the Constitution's requirement, basically, that this be by secret ballot. So states have lots of ways they try to invade the constitutional right of the elector. And what we've done is we've said we're willing to defend the right of an elector to make the judgment whether he or she will exercise a vote of conscience as opposed to voting how he or she has pledged.
And what actually happens when the electors cast their votes? Where are they and how is it done?
Well, the framers were very keen to make sure the electors could not be manipulated or coerced by some central force. So they said the electors have to meet in their separate state capitals. So every capital will be visited by these electors on Monday, and they will all cast their ballots at basically the same time. So, you know, in 1792 is the first election. They never thought that there would be any way to coordinate across 50 or across the 13 states as there were then. But now, of course, we have Twitter and we have Skype and we have lots of ways that they could communicate, but still it's the same structure. And when they vote, their votes are they're supposed to be, we think the constitutional scheme is, that they vote by secret ballot, and then the ballots are open. They determine how the votes in the states have been cast.
So how often have electors in the past gone against how they were supposed to or expected to vote?
Well, in 9 of the last 17 presidential elections, you've had electors who voted against how they've pledged. It's never mattered in the presidential elections, although it did matter pretty interestingly in the vice presidential election. It's basically the same structure for the vice presidential election. But in 1836, Virginia's delegates refused to vote for the Vice President Johnson because Vice President Johnson was alleged to have African-American as a lover. So they refused to endorse him as vice president. And so that meant their votes were withheld, and he didn't get the majority vote that he needed in the Electoral College, and it had to go to the Senate, and the Senate had to decide whether he would be vice president or not, and they finally decided he would be.
We're talking right now with Lawrence Lessig. He is a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School and co-founder of the Electors Trust, a group that offers free legal counsel to any elector in the Electoral College who wants to vote for someone other than the candidate who won their state. So this has been a very unusual election and post-election period. What is it about this year that has inspired you to really reach out to those electors who you think may be thinking of not voting the way that they are expected to?
Well, this is really an unprecedented presidential election. There's never been a presidential election where there is so much groundswell to call for the electors to exercise their independent judgment. And there are a number of reasons for that, I think. One big reason is, once again, we have an election where the person who won the majority, and not just a slight majority as in 2000, but a very significant majority, you know, probably in the end will be about 3 million votes, is not, if the electors vote in their normal way, going to be nominated as president. And that troubles many people because the scheme that we've fixed on now presumptively says that, you know, the person who gets the most votes wins. But it turns out it doesn't, and not because of the Constitution. This is something people miss. It's because of the way states allocate the votes. If this winner-take-all system didn't exist, if you just divided the votes on the basis of the proportion that each candidate got, then the chances of having this kind of inverted election, where the winner of the popular vote does not win the election, would reduce substantially. So it's because of the state rules that we have this problem. And that creates a certain frustration because I think a lot of people in the majority think, you know, being in the majority should matter. But more than that, I think that many Republican electors are looking at a couple very significant facts about Donald Trump that give them great pause. So Richard Painter, who's a Republican, George Bush's ethics czar, has been quite vocal about Donald Trump's refusal to divest himself of his foreign assets. And that's going to create an obvious conflict under the Constitution's foreign bribery clause. The framers were very afraid that a president would have assets or interest in foreign countries and then be controllable by those foreign countries because the king or the government in those foreign countries would give him benefits that might lead him not to be concerned about the interests of America enough. And indeed, if you remember at the beginning of the presidential campaign, Donald Trump made this point very strongly when he was criticizing other candidates running for the Republican nominee. He was basically trying to attack Jeb Bush, but he said, you know, how can we trust that Jeb Bush will do what is in the public interest if all the time he's thinking about what his super PAC, who has given him $1 million, wants him to do? And that was a great point he made, because super PACs do have that dynamic. But if you're worried about a super PAC, you should be worried 1,000 times more about a president who has $300 million loan from Deutsche Bank or has hundreds of millions of dollars in loans from Chinese banks. How can he sit there and negotiate with the Germans or the Chinese and think about the American interest exclusively if in the back of his head he's worried what will happen because of these banks holding my loans? Or the same thing with his assets, you know, Trump Towers or, I mean, Trump properties that might be held overseas. So this is a very serious constitutional problem. And as Richard Painter says, unless he's willing to divest himself, then an elector cannot, in good faith, in good conscience, vote for a man who is in violation, plain violation of the Constitution. And the second thing that's troubling many electors is this whole discovery about the Russian involvement in our elections. You know, first of all, this again was exactly what the framers were worried about. They thought foreign involvement inside of our government would make it impossible for us to govern ourselves. And here you've got a really extraordinary effort by a government to intervene, and confirmed by our security forces now, intelligence security forces. And indeed, after the election, the Russians were quite open about their connection to the Trump campaign. And I think many people are saying, in a context where you can imagine the Chinese doing the same thing, the Pakistanis doing the same, anybody engaging in the same kind of intervention, we've got to become zero tolerant of foreign governments trying to intervene in our elections. And if you benefit from it, and you knowingly benefit from it, then you shouldn't get rewarded for that by getting the nomination or the confirmation as president.
Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig is with us to talk about the Electors Trust, a group he co-founded offering pro bono legal representation to Republican electors who decide to vote for someone other than the candidate who won their state.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you support a Republican elector who votes for someone other than Donald Trump? Should an elector vote their conscience or abide by the outcome in his or her state? What do you think about the function and the existence of the Electoral College? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig is with us to talk about the Electors Trust. That's a group he co-founded offering pro bono legal representation to electors who decide to vote for someone other than the candidate who won their state.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should electors go with their state's outcome, or should they vote their conscience? Should they be evaluating the qualifications of the president they're expected to vote for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we do have some callers who want to join the conversation, so let's go first to Jerry in Waterford. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an independent, so I have voted both Democratic and Republican in various elections. And I've always supported the candidate who has won, but I've never voted for anarchy. And what this gentleman's talking about today is going to be anarchy if the electors do not follow what people have voted for. They had 6,000 people, I understand, from the paper over there for Donald Trump. Can you imagine what those people are going to do if the elector doesn't follow what he's supposed to, what he's pledged to do. And you also mentioned about the fact that the interference by a foreign government in the United States election, I'm sure you know back in 1996 that the United States funneled $10.2 billion to Yeltsin in the election there in Russia, and that was instrumental in him winning that election.
All right. Thanks for that call, Jerry, and let's let Lawrence Lessig respond to that. So, Jerry, concerned about if this actually happens, what it would mean for the country and stability.
Well, first, he also said something very important about interference in foreign elections, and I think that's wrong, too. And especially in the age of cyber attacks, if we don't draw a clear line and live up to it ourselves, we're going to be incredibly vulnerable to the games that these hackers are playing. And so I think we need to be very clear and very strong about that. You know, as to whether there would be anarchy, I believe in the Constitution. I believe in what the Constitution structures and establishes. And what's clear, again, as Jackson said, is that these electors were to be free agents exercising independent judgment. Now, what that means is when they make a pledge, they better have a very good reason for deviating from that pledge. If they don't have a good reason, they shouldn't do it. It would be wrong for them to do it. And what we're actually not in the business of persuading anybody one way or the other. I think this is a judgment for the electors. But what we're doing is making clear to the electors that they are free to make that judgment, and we'll protect them if, in fact, they get attacked legally by making their judgment according to their conscience. That's what the Constitution imagines. You don't like that? Then let's amend the Constitution. Let's get rid of the Electoral College. Let's just have an automatic system, allocates points state by state, and then that's who decides the election. But that's not what the framers wanted. They wanted them to deliberate and decide, and that's our Constitution, and we should respect it. And if you don't respect it, I think that's anarchy. That's violating the principle that we've inherited from our forefathers.
Let's go back to the phones, and Frank in Burlington is next. Hi, Frank.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I look at the 2.6 million U.S. citizens who did not vote for the Donald, and my concern is, you know, I liked the last caller's question about anarchy, but how are you, sir, contacting the electors and giving them this support and really good encouragement? And then, two, as a citizen, how can I contact the electors to also let them know of my concern towards and offer them my support for voting what's best for the country and what the 2.6 million Americans voted for?
Thanks for that call, Frank. And Lawrence, how are you actually reaching out to those electors?
Well, there's actually three different groups who are doing basically what we're doing. We're the least aggressive. So our group basically has, if you go to our website, electorstrust.org, there's a way for electors to reach out to our lawyers. They don't talk to me because it's very important we maintain perfect confidentiality, so they have a attorney-client relationship with our lawyers, and they only talk to their lawyers. There's another group called Hamilton Electors who have reached out. They've gone out and they've begun to speak to the electors directly. And then there's a Republican group led by a Boston Republican lawyer, a person I've known for a while, a very respected lawyer named R.J. Lyman. And he himself has gone elector to elector calling them and talking to them. And again, he doesn't persuade. He's not saying don't vote for Donald Trump. He's saying here's what the framers meant you to do, and you should exercise your conscience. You should exercise your judgment, and you decide whether you can vote according to how you're pledged. So he's actually identified, as he reported on a show that I was on with him two nights ago, 17 electors himself who have not promised not to vote against Donald Trump, but who have expressed to him that they're seriously considering it. And what we know is, you know, if they don't get close to 37, I imagine most of these will just vote for Donald Trump because they don't want to get into the trouble of having stepped out. But there will be some who, regardless of the number, will step out. Now, you know, There have also been a lot of creative people trying to find out how, you know, create ways to reach the electors. There's a site called makedemocracymatter.org, which actually gives you a direct way to contact them. But, you know, these electors have been so overwhelmed with people reaching out to them. And I feel so sorry for them at this moment, because it is a very difficult decision. They are doing an important service for our country. And, you know, I would say that at this point, they know. They know the issues, and they know what they need to do. And I think what they have to do is go to church on Sunday and think very carefully about what they're going to do, or their synagogue on Saturday, and then on Monday make their decision. And I trust that they will take the role that the framers expected them to take.
So let's do a hypothetical here, Lawrence. The numbers of electors that would need to defect hits 37, and so then Donald Trump doesn't have his 270 electoral votes. What would happen then?
Well, then the top three candidates would be immediately sent to the House of Representatives, and the House of Representatives would start taking ballots, and they would vote one vote per state. Which is itself kind of extraordinary. So that means that Rhode Island gets as much power in this as California does. But that's the constitutional system. And they would vote until one of the candidates gets a majority of the votes. Now, the Republicans have an overwhelming majority in state delegations, except there are a number of states where, you know, the number that turns the majority is just one representative or two representatives. So it's pretty clear there would most likely be a Republican. It could be Donald Trump. But many people think that at that point, what the House would think is that they need to elect a candidate who could begin to unite a very divided nation. And so it wouldn't be Hillary Clinton. It wouldn't be Donald Trump. It would it could be someone standing between. And that opportunity, I think, is making a lot of people think, what's the best way to get us through this if, in fact, it gets into the House of Representatives?
Has Donald Trump made any comments related to your efforts and those of the other two groups working on this?
Well, quite extraordinarily, Donald Trump has basically threatened the electors, which is extraordinary because it's, in fact, a federal crime to threaten electors. The statute explicitly says you can't coerce or threaten federal presidential electors. But it's, you know, this is, I think, of all the mistakes Donald Trump has made about the Constitution and about the law, the most understandable, because most people think of the electors as just cogs in a wheel whose job is basically just to reflect what the vote has done. And that's just because for most of the time, that's how they've acted. But once you begin to really understand what the framers meant, why they created them the way they did, and you read Hamilton in Federalist 68, and you talk about the kind of person they were trying to make sure the electors would have a chance to stop, you realize that these are actual people who are supposed to exercise real judgment, and that judgment should be respected, and you shouldn't threaten somebody, you shouldn't bribe somebody, you shouldn't do anything. You should let them make their judgment just like you allow a juror to make a judgment or you allow a representative to make a judgment.
And in just the minute that we have left, Lawrence, do you think that the Electoral College is an institution that we should be keeping, or do you think we should be going to a completely different system?
I think we should abolish the winner-take-all part of the Electoral College. I think we should have a system that's as close to one person, one vote as possible. But I think this election has convinced me that I'm not actually sure it's a bad thing to have a kind of final check, you know, a kind of emergency break process. You know, and 56 times in our history, the electors have met and they've not pulled that emergency break. But it's probably not a terrible thing that they're able to pull it if, in fact, it's necessary. And that's
Lawrence, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lawrence Lessig is professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. He's the co-founder of the Electors Trust, a group that offers legal counsel to electors who are considering changing their votes.
Big news in the the video game nostalgia world. Today, for the first time, the Super Mario franchise makes its way into the world of smartphones and tablets.
Nintendo is releasing Super Mario Run for iPhones and iPads. The Mario franchise is one of the best-selling video game franchises of all time, but was only sold for consoles made for Nintendo.
It's pricey as game apps go. $10, where a lot of games are $1 or $2 or even free, but they sell you stuff, you know, once you download it.
Mario first appeared in the arcade game Donkey Kong in 1981. He was briefly known as Mr. Video and Jumpman in various stages of development.
And I have played Mario games in various stages. I played Donkey Kong at the arcades back then. He was already Mario by the time I got there, though. And various Nintendo console permutations of games. And my kids have played some, too.
So I have to say, I got really excited about this news because my nephews, Kevin and Peter, who I'll be seeing for the holidays in a week or so, we used to play Super Mario Party to the extent that the other adults were having to kind of pry us away from them. And I have to admit, as Aunt Judy, I was not setting a very good example. So I'm pretty excited about this.
You're just playing the cool aunt card.
Exactly.
Playing the Mario games.
Well, I always had that status. So.
All right. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.